Film Spotting is presented by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair and eat men like air. If Sylvia Plath had written screenplays instead of poems, my guess is that character would have been a strong contender for this week's Film Spotting Top 5. Inspired by the heroine in Pixar's latest film, we'll reveal our favorite screen redheads.
Plus Massacre Theater and the third film in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, Children of Heaven. But first, you may take Princess Merida's life, but you'll never take her freedom.
In accordance with our laws, the firstborn of each of the great leaders must prove their worth. Merida, stop!
A lady enjoys elegant pursuits.
I present my only son. He took out a whole armada single-handedly. He was... with one arm, he was stealing the ship.
I want my freedom. But are you willing to pay the price your freedom will cost?
Careful what you wish for, my mother would say.
What's the worst that can happen?
Well, Josh, it's only happened a handful of times over 7+ years that we're discussing a film right after the screening, but that's the predicament we find ourselves in after seeing Pixar's Brave. And tying in with this film, we solicited our top five themes last week on the show and on Facebook and Twitter. We basically wanted some help from listeners to come up with a good idea, and one that stuck with me, even though we didn't use it, came from Twitter. Emily, Twitter handle Ballroom Pink, wrote in and said, since Brave is Pixar's first film with a female hero, how about film firsts or ones where you exclaimed, it's about time? And I never really thought of it until that tweet, but of course she's right. From Bug's Life to Finding Nemo to the Toy Story movies, all previous 12 Pixar films center on male protagonists, or as male a protagonist can be when he's a car or a robot. Brave is the story of a tomboyish princess, voiced by the great Kelly MacDonald, who sets out to change her destiny when her parents, King Fergus and Queen Eleanor, are determined to follow tradition and have her marry one of three potential suitors. While she may mark a first for Pixar proper, the fact is that the first sound we hear when we go to a Pixar movie is When You Wish Upon a Star, accompanying the Walt Disney logo. And in the long line of headstrong, plucky princesses, Merida seems pretty comparable to, say, Ariel from The Little Mermaid, determined to live the life she wants to lead without following the role prescribed for her by her parents. There seems to me, though, one notable exception to every animated Disney heroine that comes to the top of my mind. Princess Merida is not interested in finding her Prince Charming. This is not about a girl finding the right boy. Josh, was that variation a compelling enough hook for you?
It was, because this movie really goes in a direction that I didn't expect, given the advertising campaign and how they are selling it as another kind of girl princess power through boy activities, mm-hmm. which a lot of Disney films have done. And it starts out this way. My heart was sinking throughout the first third of this movie because I just kept thinking, this is all they're really going to do? Because it seems to be just that, where she's arranged to be married to one of these three guys, doesn't want to be a part of it, kind of shows that, you know, she can beat them at archery too. Mm-hmm. And I thought, are we really going to, knowing that this had a relatively short running time for a Pixar film, I thought, are we really just going to see Pixar's variation on that theme? But there is a direction this goes into, and without giving the details of how it does that, because it's a really lovely, scary, strange surprise that totally changes the dynamic of the movie,
right,
in terms of the girl power theme. In a way, it's unfortunate that we still do have to talk about this dichotomy when it comes to kids' movies, but I think it's probably it's a reality that's always going to be there. Boys and girls are different. And I really think that's an interesting point made by the person on Twitter in your intro, that Pixar hasn't done a girl movie, quote unquote, whatever that means. Maybe Toy Story 2 is possibly the
Jesse
closest.
Jesse plays a major role.
Yeah, I'm kind of going through the titles
you
in my head
here. You still think of it, though, as Buzz and Woody.
You do. And so I think that's probably true. And not only is this maybe more girl-centric, but Brave struck me. I've talked before how I feel Pixar movies are for parents first, kids secondary. This one really hit me in terms of this is a movie for moms who have about to be tween girls.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of mother-daughter relationship stuff here that is so rich and nuanced. I really enjoyed that part of it, even though obviously I'm not a mother. I do have a soon-to-be tween daughter. And I saw some variations there that I really appreciated. Now, on top of that, it has a lot of the adventure stuff, too. So there were a lot of layers here that it took a little while to get to them. But mm-hmm. I think that's intentional. It's part of the setup. But once they got to them, this was a really rich film.
I really liked it, too. I think I appreciated many of the same things you did. In fact, that variation, not just the fact that we have this princess who doesn't really seem interested in boys at all, but we have the fact that it is a mother-daughter story. And I think of so many other Disney movies where it's always a case that the daughter is rebelling against her father, the strict father. I'm sure that there are exceptions that people who are Disney disciples out there can point out. But the fact is, I think a lot of the common traits involve girls battling their dads. And I love the fact that this becomes a really interesting mother-daughter story, a very specific mother-daughter story that then makes it universal. As you said, whether you have daughters or you have three boys and a daughter like I do, I think that you can find connections.
You're muttering.
I don't mutter.
Aye, you do. You mutter less when something's troubling you.
I blamed you. Stubbornness. It's entirely from your side of the family.
I take it the talk didn't go too well, then.
I don't know what to do.
Speak to her, dear.
I do speak to her. She just doesn't listen.
Come on, now. Pretend I'm Merida. Speak to me. What would you say?
I can't do this.
Sure you can. There. That's my queen. Right, here we go. I don't want to get married. I want to stay single and let my hair flow in the wind as I ride through the glen, firing arrows into the sunset.
And this is what I love so much about Pixar, but you can say it for the best DreamWorks animated films too, is they take time out from the story and the action and the comedy to have little reflective, insightful moments. And we get a great one that speaks right to what we're trying to get at with this film in terms of the mother-daughter relationship, where she's getting Princess Merida all dressed up. The mom is getting her daughter dressed up to go and meet the suitors. It's a big deal. Of course, she's rebelling against it a little bit. She's wearing really tight, constricted clothing, and she doesn't like that, and her hair isn't showing. And her hair, obviously, here inspiring our top five, is such a key character distinction for her. It is her. It's wild and untamed and just reflects her free spirit, and she keeps pulling out a strand. So
yeah,
she
that curl is great. She wants it showing, her mother wants it hidden.
Right. I love that little bit of her personality having to come out. But what happens is she finally gets her daughter to look the way she should look, like a proper princess. And she seems like she's okay with it. She's actually kind of pleased with it. And she gives her a little lesson and says, just remember to smile. And in that moment, you see just that little bit of heartbreak where the mom realizes that, okay, I wanted this and now I got it. But what I'm getting with it is a grown-up.
Yeah.
I'm getting a grown-up. I'm getting a girl who is no longer going to be my little girl. She's going to be someone who's going to go out and find her own path. And while that's great, potentially, the fact is you're losing her. And I love that the movie takes time out for those moments.
And on top of that, I think there's a realization on the mother's part that she's dampening her personality, too.
Right.
So there's a recognition that, oh, this is what I was going for, but I've lost something
right.
as well. So, yeah, there are a lot of nuances here. A title that came to mind as you were talking about the daughter rebelling against the father and the mother-daughter dynamic, Tangled, not too recently.
Which I haven't seen, unfortunately.
It's a really good entry. It is. Yeah, it kind of went unnoticed, but there are some interesting variations there as well. Towards the climax of Brave, I love how they have Merida's heroic acts combine a number of things. And this is where it's different than some of those girl power movies of the past where all they really do is adopt boy stereotypes. So mm-hmm. again, it's the archery, it's the sword fighting. We can do it too. And that's where the movie stops. But the climax here, without giving it away, involves archery. It involves sword fighting. It also involves sewing. I just love that ironic touch, how they weave that in there.
Yep.
And what we get is this amalgamation of, it's no longer just boy stuff or a girl doing boy stuff, or all those definitions kind of fall by the wayside. And these are just the necessary actions that have to take place. They come naturally out of her personality. So she arises as a genuine person. Really, the character that comes to mind who Disney did similarly was Belle. Belle is kind of her own person. She's not the princess, obviously, but she's also not the tomboy. She has her own distinct qualities. And I think Merida here in Brave is, you know, a good successor to that character.
I am Merida, firstborn descendant of Clan Dunbrog, and I'll be shooting for my own hand.
What are you doing?
Merida!
Curse this dress!
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson talking about Pixar's new film. It's out this weekend, Brave. I wonder, though, as much as I do hate to rank Pixar movies, and I don't really think it's important, but at the same time, I was thinking about this movie in the context of the larger Pixar universe.
Yeah, it's hard not to, but you're right. I don't know if it's fair.
It probably
isn't. I do it myself.
Well, you can't help it, because one of the reactions I have to so many Pixar movies, and I do love so many of them, is I find them genuinely amusing, often laugh-out-loud funny, and also very moving. There are very often times watching Pixar movies where I do get a little choked up, where it's a little dusty in the theater. And as much as I appreciated this film, I did find it just sort of mildly amusing rather than comedic. And then by the end of the movie, despite there being very earned moments, I think you're right. There are some wonderful heroic acts that tie together all of the larger themes of the film. I think structurally, there's so much right with this film. The dramatic, emotional heft to the climax is absolutely earned, and yet it did not hit me.
It didn't hit you?
It didn't hit me on any kind of gut level the way so many Pixar movies do.
That climactic moment between the mother and daughter didn't get you, huh?
I don't know why it didn't.
It worked for me. It worked for me. I will say this is probably one of their least comedic films.
Yeah.
There are not the rat-a-tat jokes or the supporting characters. There are some who are supposed to be funny. Merida's little brother, she has triplet brothers, and they have some amusing moments, I think is what you said. And amusing is how I would describe
right.
it. But the comedy is not at the forefront here. I also wonder about the visual scheme. It seems that, I mean, it's beautiful. There's nothing lacking here.
No.
And it does have, you know, set in Scotland, it has this sort of mossiness that they somehow get. It's almost like a fecund look that's on the screen. But beyond that, there aren't any like show-stopping visuals, which make you kind of like gasp, that Pixar usually does. So that's maybe putting it a little lower tier.
Hmm.
But the narrative, I think it's one of their strongest narratives.
Well, I agree with what you're saying in terms of there not being maybe any major bravura visual moments. At the same time, I really responded to the visual look of this film. I love the way that they're able to sort of mimic epic film crane shots where you swoop in on
a
certain scenario and they'll rack focus where something like a bird, there's a great sequence where we get this wonderful overhead shot and a bird will kind of come into the frame and then we'll get the focus shift in another direction. It's very cinematic, and that sounds obvious, but for a film that's animated, they aren't always cinematic, and you definitely get that sense here. And I love the fact that not only do they take time out for those moments I talked about, like with the mother and daughter, which isn't so much a visual moment as just kind of taking a time out from the story, but you'll get a great close-up, like the one where she's competing in this archery competition where she's trying to show up her suitors, and we get to the third one, and her mom has basically forbidden her to shoot that last arrow, and it just really slows down, and we get this great close-up where we even see the feather of the arrow. I'm forgetting the actual term for that, but the way it grazes her cheek, that makes it so dramatic and so cool, frankly. I love those moments.
And her expression there, which they do close in on, is amazing for animation because it captures the rebelliousness, but also the, whoa, I just did that, the awareness of the repercussions of her action. It's all there
exactly.
in that face.
Yeah.
Visually, I should also give credit to, it's not exactly a villain, but there is a character of this ferocious bear, this kind of legendary bear
mm-hmm.
that in the opening scene, we see her father battling. And that's a pretty impressive creation, that bear. I mean, he's huge and he's got these bear patches, arrows sticking out of him, glowing eyes. That'll go down. Take kids to that. They're going to have nightmares. nightmares about that bear, probably.
I think we should mention the 3D real quick, because we've certainly bemoaned the fact that we have to see these movies in 3D. We'd really rather not, but I was especially wary when I saw some folks on Twitter, some of the people we both follow, who've seen earlier screenings of this movie, talk about how dark the film is. And that happens. I mentioned it with Avengers. I didn't feel like I was really getting a sense of the action because I thought the screen was frankly too dark most of the time. Here, maybe we just saw a decent projection of it, Josh, but it certainly didn't take away from the movie for me at all. In fact, I thought there were some wonderful depth moments that 3D can provide. And I thought in terms of overall brightness, the film worked in terms of its 3D.
Yeah, it was bright enough. I'd say that. I don't think the depth that was done here is necessarily because of the 3D, though. I mean, Pixar films well before 3D had that sort of depth to them, and I don't think that added anything. I think this is another one of those 3D films we can say, oh, it didn't hurt it, so aren't we glad we paid extra money?
Yeah, maybe so, but I really do wonder. I would love to compare some of those great depth shots from other Pixar films against the scene, like I mentioned, where the bird flies kind of into the screen. It isn't a matter of the bird flying close to you and having that 3D wow moment, but there's just a foreground and a backgrounding that happens, and it gives it a real sturdy sense of depth that I'm not sure non-3D would do.
Yeah, a screenshot-by-screenshot comparison would be interesting.
I think, though, one of the other issues I did have with this movie gets back to what you said in terms of the comedy, and some of the supporting characters maybe really aren't that funny. I would also say that I found some of the supporting characters, in fact, I found every character but the two main ones, the daughter and the mother, to be maybe a little bit too broad, even for this animated film. If you think about other Pixar movies, it makes sense maybe to have characters be really broadly defined when they are a child's toy or they're a car and they're sort of exhibiting a set behavior that we need them to follow, and we need that to make sense on a human level. But watching this film, where we're actually watching real human beings, even though it's a comedy and even though it's a fairy tale largely, you've got the three brothers, all the suitors, the king, even basically every character you meet in this film is sketched a certain way to either try to elicit laughs or just to fulfill a certain role that the story needs them to. They don't really feel as flesh and blood as I'd like them to, even in an animated film.
Yeah, I can see that. And they certainly don't provide the laughs, as I mentioned. What I did appreciate about all the characters, though, and including the suitors, is how physically different. This is something that Pixar is so good at doing, is just the creativity in physically presenting different looks for their characters.
Right.
And if you look at the different styles each of these three suitors has, it's just amazing how they can come up with that with their physical features and other elements. So
yeah.
I was kind of, you know, just enjoyed seeing that. But you're right, they're not full-blooded characters like we're kind of used to in Pixar films.
We talked about the structure of this film and the narrative, and we both responded positively to it. Did it bother you at all, or am I just being nitpicky, that at a major point in the story involving something we're not going to give away at all, the two main characters, the mother and daughter, disappear for an entire night and come back the next day? Not only do they disappear, her brothers disappear as well, and they come back a full 24 hours later, and we're just supposed to believe that the king and all the guys are so tied up in their drinking and squabbling and fighting and whatever that they don't notice. He doesn't notice that his wife and his kids are gone. That didn't bother you?
No, they were partying.
Maybe it will bother you now that I've brought it up.
No, I see what you're saying. And I did think about that. When they returned, I did think about that. It's like, well, how's he going to react? And then he didn't really react. And I thought, oh, he didn't notice. So that's all right.
You were going so strongly with the film, just flowing with it. You excuse
it. It's okay.
Okay.
I saved my concerns about improbable things for movies like Prometheus.
Yeah, obviously. Brave is out wide this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. You must do it in a Scottish accent, though. You can also find us on Twitter @filmspotting and over at Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting.
Not one, but two accents are ahead in this week's Massacre Theater. Then, to restore our credibility, we'll return to our contemporary Iranian film marathon for a discussion of Children of Heaven.
So here's my question. Do we have to share a microphone for the whole discussion like the kids in this movie have to share that one pair of sneakers?
No, we'll keep the two microphones, please.
Okay, good.
Stay with us.
I was born an April Fool, full of gold, two brothels. Saved all my sins. We'll be right back.
Well, if you like listening to podcasts, there's a really good chance you like listening to audiobooks as well. And we've got a few recommendations for you as Film Spotting is brought to you once again by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. You can listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the show you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered. And we do really enjoy featuring listener recommendations of audiobooks that you've had a chance to check out for yourselves and that you recommend to other Film Spotting listeners. We get them via email. We also get them very frequently on our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting. And this one, Josh, from Tammy Smith in Lakewood, Colorado, came in via email.
I can recommend the Ernest Cline book, Ready Player One, as an Audible download choice. Being a child of the 80s myself, I loved all the references. It was a fantastic read full of adventure, humor, love, and 80s nostalgia. Though it's 80s with a twist, it's actually set in a futuristic world. Lots of old movie references abound. I think your audience would love it. And maybe in a few years, you'll be reviewing the movie version of the book on your podcast. I hope so, anyway. IMDb has the release date set for 2014.
And Tammy was inspired to send that pick in, actually, from our poll question a couple weeks ago, where we asked about Ghostbusters and Back to the Future. Which activity would you rather participate in, hanging out with the Ghostbusters or hanging out with Doc Brown in the DeLorean? So Tammy thought Ready Player One was appropriate for that. I think we've actually featured that book on the show before, but I want to say it was a very long time ago, and it does sound so good. I thought it was worth bringing up again. We also got this one via Facebook from James Sheridan, who I believe is in Houston, Texas. He says, I love Audible. Books I've enjoyed listening to include Faithful by Stephen King and Stuart Onan about the Boston Red Sox fateful run of the 2004 World Series, as well as the great Sebastian Younger's A Death in Belmont about an eerie coincidental meeting between his family and the Boston Strangler. Both are compulsively easy to listen to, and a final choice would be Chuck Palahniuk's Stranger Than Fiction essays, all nonfiction, which prove that the author behind Fight Club will always be innovative and controversial, as well as a powerful voice for our times. I love all three of these titles, even though I'm a White Sox fan. Thank you, James, for that one. And we do encourage you, again, if you've got a great Audible recommendation, go to our Facebook page and share it there on our wall, or just send it in to feedback@filmspotting.net.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
Let's do a head count here. Your brother, the demigod, a super soldier, living legend who kind of lives up to the legend, a man with breathtaking anger management issues, a couple of master assassins, and you, big fella, you've managed to piss off every single one of them.
That was the plan.
Not a great plan.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Tom Hiddleston's Loki talking with Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man from, of course, The Avengers, the big hit of the summer. And we're going to find out a little bit later in this segment with this week's poll question whether or not all the other top films of the year should fear The Avengers or not. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Hey, Luke. You want to feel something permanent? Just put your hand underneath my cap. Just get a little lump. Knock on all on St. Patty's Day, Boston.
I got that beat. Some moray eel. Fit right through my wetsuit.
Well, nope, no. Listen, I don't know about that, but I entered an arm wrestling contest in Loki Bar in San Francisco. You see this? Now I can't extend that. You know why? Got to the semifinal. Celebrating my third wife's demise. Big Chinese fella, pull me right off.
That's Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss from 1975's Jaws, directed, of course, by Steven Spielberg, not directed by Akira Kurosawa.
No?
His remake of Jaws. Everyone's familiar with that one, starring Toshirô Mifune. Apparently, Josh, you got confused by that. I love that multiple listeners pointed out that your performance crossed this line where you were blurring Mifune and Robert Shaw.
More than one person thought that too, and I did not have that in my head at all. I just want you to know that's not what I was going for.
I think you set back American-Japanese relations a good 25 years.
Very well could be.
The script written by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb, and the tie-in, well, one of our listeners, John, with his film spotting nickname, The Penultimate Pestilence, he had several.
He had four. He really went overboard. Let's share these. His first, with your sister's sister, there are three people trapped on an island working out their emotional issues. In Jaws, it's three guys trapped on a boat working out their fishing issues. Number two, for safety not guaranteed, none of those three guys in Jaws had any guaranteed safety before they went shark hunting. Number three, for the top five crackpots, everyone on that boat may have been a crackpot. At first glance, it's Quint that comes to mind as the most crackpot of the crew. But thinking about it a little more, Hooper was pretty obsessed with his sharks, possibly to the detriment of his well-being. And then Brody, what the heck was he doing out there?
In fact, it was number three, the crackpots. That was the very obvious one we were going
for. That was our reason.
That was our reason, but John went on with his number four. Recently, you gentlemen have been upping the stakes in Massacre Theater, each time making me amazed at just how badly you can destroy movie dialogue. You're trying very hard, I see. And here with Jaws, you take one of the greatest acting performances in all of movie history, Robert Shaw's Quint. I heard Quint's words butchered, dare I say chummed, to depths so deep that no light can be seen. Haven't you walked the plank for such a performance? Aye, is what we should be having you do.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you, John, for that. Wow. With that, let's go ahead and reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
We do have a winner. It's Kyle Clemenson from Minneapolis.
Congratulations, Kyle. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your prize.
How did I come to this?
Not again.
I played Richard III.
Five curtain calls.
Five curtain calls. I was an actor once. Damn it now, look at me. Look at me! I can't go out there and I won't say that stupid line one more time.
Well, let's see how badly we can destroy movie dialogue this week. It is time for Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
This week's winner will get a complimentary 6-month subscription to Fandor. And as we get to this scene, the tie-in is pretty clearly, we think, with one of the films we're going to discuss on this week's show. And we should note that the opinions expressed by the characters in this scene do not express those of this show.
No,
or
that,
the
that's
hosts.
Good to point out.
Good, maybe, to point out. Wow, I start this off, and I'm pretty sure I'm not ready, despite practicing in the shower this morning, practicing in the car on the way over here. I'm sure I was getting some crazy looks from
like
people.
It sounds like plenty of preparation.
Well, let's go with it. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
Why do you want to join the force?
To protect the property.
Oh, please, don't waste my time with that BS. Where are you from, Stone?
From the South Side.
Stone? George Stone? That's your name? What's your real name?
That is my real name.
Nah, what was it before you changed it?
Giuseppe Petri.
Jeez, I knew it. That's all you need. One thieving wop on the team.
What's that you said?
I said that you're a lion member of a no-good race.
That's much better than you, you stinking Irish pig.
Oh, I like him.
And scene.
I really think you probably should have done it. After last week, you could have really...
the shower preparation. It paid off.
It paid off?
I loved it.
Well, if you know what film we just massacred, Stone, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, June 26th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over. What are we going to do now? What are we going to do?
Maybe we could build a fire, sing a couple of songs, huh? Why don't we try that?
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
A scene there from James Cameron's Aliens, the follow-up to Ridley Scott's Alien, and that sets us up nicely for our poll results. Going back to last week, we were rehashing our previous discussion of Prometheus, which we had a nice fight about as well in our bonus content last week. And since this film has been so divisive, and it seems that many people have seen it and everybody has an opinion about it, we wanted to try to get the final verdict on Prometheus. We gave you these options. It is an abomination, a flawed but worthy entry in the alien mythology, a la Aliens. It's a masterpiece, or I don't care, I won't see it. Josh, tell everyone how smart our listeners are.
It's not as divisive among film spotting listeners.
No.
I'm kind of surprised. No one really thinks it's an abomination. 9%. That's the group I would put myself in, but I'm kind of lonely. A masterpiece? Only 10%. So
still
not,
more than an abomination. Not, said it was a masterpiece. I think they did it just to spite you, though.
I think so, too.
They just wanted to get your blood going.
Don't care. Won't see it. 14%. 67% think it's a flawed but worthy entry in alien mythology, which
correct.
Is where you landed, right?
Indeed.
I don't know about that. Well, James in Texas says, clearly not the masterpiece of Alien, but Prometheus is a reach towards greatness and profundity, with an unmatched brilliance of visuals and some visceral terror. Scott's execution of this film is strong, even with some very unclear choices and shortcuts.
I think that sums it up pretty well. But then we have Aaron, who wrote in the poll, I'm somewhere between the first two choices. It certainly wasn't an abomination, but to call it worthy of the Alien franchise is a little much. After two of the greatest films of all time, Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection weren't worthy either. It was a curious film with a few elements of greatness, but if you think it's in the ballpark as Alien or Aliens, then I don't know what to tell you, Aaron writes.
Yeah, it's definitely not in the ballpark. And James' point about the visceral terror, I would even argue that has problems too. That whole dust storm sequence.
Save it.
We just can't even bring this up if you don't want me to go off again about it.
No, it did get pretty heated in our app bonus content last week. So if you haven't heard that and you just can't get enough of the Prometheus fighting, you can get the Film Spotting app through iTunes or Amazon's App World. And more information about our apps is available at filmspotting.net. This week, we're going to get to some feedback that we've been storing up over the past few shows, preparing for show number 400. We got a little bit sidetracked, but we did our top five actor-director collaborations we'd like to see, basically take an actor or actress and a director that we like and have them make a film together because they've never worked together before. You guys all had some really great ideas, and so we'll share that in our bonus content feedback. Let's get to this week's poll question, Josh, and it goes back to that clip of Avengers, which is the juggernaut film so far this year and perhaps of all time. And next week on the show, it's the mid-year point. We're going to have Michael Phillips on from the Chicago Tribune for his regular monthly appearance, and we're going to share our top five films of the year so far. So setting that up, we want to know what you think the best film of 2012 so far is.
The Avengers, The Cabin in the Woods, Moonrise Kingdom, Prometheus,
mm-hmm.
The Secret World of Arrietty, or Other.
And of course, Other will probably do pretty well in this poll as there have been a whole lot more than five movies that have come out this year. But in trying to come up with a tidy poll question, I feel like if you look at Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes and even the box office with some of those films, and even our feedback, these are the films that have come up most regularly from listeners that seem to really galvanize audiences, really got a lot of film fans pumped up. Wes Anderson's latest, what Drew Goddard and Joss Whedon were doing in Cabin in the Woods, what Whedon did in The Avengers. And there's a movie like The Secret World of Arrietty that a lot of people, including us, appreciate
as
well.
Yeah, I'm glad to see that on here.
So we want to know what you think the best film of 2012 so far is. Vote now at filmspotting.net.
کفش خیلی کثیف شده. مردم نمیاد بپوشمش.
باز داری بهونه میاری یا؟
نه به خود کفش خیلی کثیف شده.
خب میشوریمش.
That is The Brother and Sister of Children of Heaven, the latest film in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. And these marathons are chances for us to explore a genre or a director that we aren't all that familiar with and just look deeply into it and kind of bolster up our own film knowledge. Director Majid Majidi has connections to other filmmakers we've discussed so far in this marathon. He was an actor, actually, in Mohsin Makhmalbaf's Boycott, for example. Yet based on Children of Heaven and the storylines for his other films, his style and recurring themes are quite different from theirs. The simple tale of a brother and sister who trade a single pair of shoes back and forth so that their parents don't realize they've lost their only other pair, Children of Heaven was an effective enough parable to become the first Iranian movie nominated for a foreign language Oscar in 1997. Unlike other films in this marathon, Children of Heaven operates purely at face value. The actors are clearly actors. The story is a straightforward narrative. There isn't a single reference to filmmaking itself that I caught. I don't know. Maybe there was one. So the question, Adam, is did the relative simplicity of this movie come as a relief to you after the denseness of A Moment of Innocence and Close Up, or did the film seem slight in comparison?
Yes.
Slight? Really?
I'm saying yes, actually, to both.
Oh,
I think
okay.
It could be both at once because that's really the experience I had with this film. It was both a relief and a film that felt slight to me following Close Up and A Moment of Innocence. But then again, I think both of those films are almost transcendent movie-going experiences. I think they're movies that you could devote classes in an entire semester to really studying mm-hmm. in a larger context of the capability of cinema. So saying that doesn't really make Children of Heaven a bad movie by any means. I enjoyed it, and I'd say that for any listeners out there, this occurred to me, I wonder if you agree, if there's anybody out there feeling at all intimidated by this marathon because of the heady subject matter of the first two movies, this would be a perfect starting point. If you're not familiar with any Iranian films, like I said, maybe felt like it was too deep to wade into, I think this would be a good starting point.
It would, but I don't think it would prepare them for what those other movies are doing. I mean, it's still going to be light speed jump to get into how dense those films are compared to this.
That's a good point, but you know, it's available via streaming if people want to see it. It's only 97 minutes long. And as you said, it's a straightforward, moving narrative that basically the way I'd sum it up to someone, it's The Bicycle Thief meets Breaking Away. Instead of getting that bike back to survive, it's getting those shoes or getting another pair of shoes, but with a big feel-good race at the end of the movie as well. I also think it's a great answer to Matt Singer's Critic Wire question from last week that I participated in. He does this every Monday. If you don't check out that feature, I encourage you to do so over at IndieWire.com. He'll pose a question, basically a survey to 25 or 30 critics, and we often weigh in. And last week's challenge was, what's the art house film or foreign language film you would pick to introduce a young teen, someone say 12, 13, 14, who's just getting into it? What film would you use as a jumping off point? And I actually said in that survey, The Bicycle Thief is the movie I would pick because the narrative is so straightforward and so universal and it's such a great film. I might actually revise my answer now because after seeing Children of Heaven, I wish I had watched it with my two oldest kids who are 10 and 8. I think Holden and Sophie would have really appreciated this film.
I actually watched it with my 6-year-old daughter. And she was riveted.
I bet.
Granted, one drawback to that is she can't quite read that fast yet. So I'm reading the subtitles the whole time. So it was a little awkward experience. But it did hold her attention. I mean, she was riveted at what is going to happen with these kids and their shoes. Now, at the same time, we're making it sound childlike a little bit. And I don't think that's fair. It's also not fair really to compare this to A Moment of Innocence and Close Up. And
so different.
We say that, but we're going to do it. I mean, we give these star ratings in our marathon. And this is where I, you know, feel kind
don't
of
talk about the star
awkward.
Ratings.
I feel
They're
awkward
only on
about
our website.
That.
No one pays attention to them. We don't talk about that.
Because I think this is a film that is as rich in very different ways as those films. I felt like the fate of the world was in the balance when these kids were waiting to meet.
The stakes
and
are high. They're really high.
They are high. And it's not because of what's actually happening or how many themes are going on. It's because of how well crafted this film is, that it puts us in that child's mindset and makes us realize and remember how there were times in our lives where the simplest things were more important than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that we lose. And this is a nice reminder, especially when you think about your own kids and you sometimes feel like you're always rushing them or always trying to get to the next place or something. And something that you think is trivial, say whether it's a color crayon, you know, They want a specific color crayon to finish this project they've been working on for a week. To you, you know, we got to get out the door. It doesn't mean anything. But to them, it's the entire world that they get that particular color crayon. Something similar is going on here. Higher stakes than that, obviously, Because these kids need these shoes to get to school and so forth. But at the same time, if they had told their parents what was going on, they might have gotten yelled at. It might have been a bit of a scene for that afternoon or maybe even a day or two. But life would have gone on. They would have figured it out, I think. But we don't remember that because we're so much in these kids' heads with them, so petrified about what's going to happen if we don't pull this off.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking about the third film in our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. It's a 1997 movie called Children of Heaven. It was nominated for a Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. And I'm with you on that dynamic with the kids. The boy here who, what do you think? He's probably about 10 years old?
I think he's 9. I think they say at one point he's 9.
The actor's name, I'll try my best with it, Amir Farouk Hashimi. And he breaks your heart every time his eyes well up with tears. What a face, indeed. And I do love that relationship with the sister. It's very believable, I think, because they have their moments of sibling squabbling, but it's also very touching. You get the sense that they're in this together. And what you said, where if they just kind of came clean about it, then life would go on and this would resolve itself. But at the same time, it is so much more dramatic and complex than that, because they recognize that their mother is bedridden and taking care of a younger child as well. The father is working constantly just to try to make ends meet. They basically can't be annoyances. They can't be agents that make their parents' lives any more difficult. And in that sense, they're completely in this together, and they are working together even as much as they do have their moments where they're fighting. And I'll say this without giving anything away, even though it's a 1997 film, the movie does end in a really interesting, ambiguous way. There is a moment that you get to the end of this film that you feel like, in fact, I was really hoping for. I was going to get the big moment you've been waiting for the entire film. You're basically going to get your happy ending. And Majidi finds a way to give you a happy ending without sending you off feeling like
it's beautiful how
everything
he does that.
Has been solved and
I
the world's
it.
An amazing place and everything is going to be perfect in these kids' lives, like a Hollywood ending. It's happy, but way more complex than that.
It reveals a lot about the father, who's this figure that we're not quite sure we get a handle on throughout the film. And the ending, how he works the father's last act into that, I just love that. My six-year-old didn't like it. She wanted the more Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't like
her.
That at all. But I really thought it was handled beautifully. There are so many beautiful moments here. I'm thinking about when the brother and sister are scribbling notes back and forth to each other. The family lives in this one-room complex, so they're all together.
Right.
And the night that they discuss the shoes are lost, the parents are kind of talking in one corner, and the brother and sister don't want them to hear. So they're doing homework next to each other and scribbling and writing notes back and forth. I love that. A little bit later, they wash the shoes together in the fountain that the community shares in the courtyard. And it's this act of bonding, as you said. They're coming together. They're in this together. So they wash the shoes, and they end up blowing bubbles with the soap, that sort of thing. And one of the final images at the end where the boy puts his sore feet in the fountain, and the goldfish swim. But I mean, just such lovely moments in the movie.
Yeah, there really are. I think, though, there was a part of me, and maybe it's because I was influenced too much by Close Up and A Moment of Innocence, where I felt myself longing for something a little bit more, something a little bit more ambiguous. Because other than the ending of the film, there isn't anything really challenging about it. There are some comedic and I would say even dramatic moments. There's an accident later that kind of comes out of nowhere that felt to me a little bit forced. And the big thing that stuck out for me about this movie, and this really will strike you if you're thinking about the previous two movies, is the look of the film. I don't know how to describe it other than it felt like a TV movie in its simplicity, especially in its use of color.
Yeah, colors are very bold.
They're very bold and not in a Wes Anderson inviting, provocative way, more bland and just sort of primary. And actually, it made me think it's not even so much like a TV movie. It's more like when you watch a play. A filmed version or a TV version of a play, a stage play. That's what I felt like I was watching here. There was really nothing at all sophisticated about the look of this film.
I wouldn't say that. I think there are some very interesting shots. How about when the daughter goes back to school early on after they start sharing the shoes and all she can see are shoes?
Well, I like
so
that.
So all of a sudden it turns into that sort
of
perspective.
I almost feel like I was watching Bresson there where there's an emphasis on hands and feet.
Bresson, I thought of Mouchette a little bit about the family in the one room. Now, this family isn't nearly as destitute as that family, but there were some echoes there too. The bold colors didn't bother me. There was a feel, it was almost like some of it seemed to be on a studio set.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think
there's something
I sensed that
plastic
too. Now,
and artificial.
It couldn't have been because there are also street scenes that are really authentic. But again, that didn't bother me because this movie is doing something so different. It's such a parable. It's set in this childlike world. And so the bold colors and the artificiality didn't bother me too much. You're right. This is not an intellectual challenge, this film. And so it's not going to compete with the other movies we mentioned in that category. But I also wonder, I get a little worried about always having to talk about masterpieces that involve filmmaking and are about filmmaking.
I'm with you.
I'm always a little suspicious about that. And so Close Up and A Moment of Innocence are both very much like that. And so they cater to film theorists and film critics, and it's kind of this incestuous circle. You know, we love it because it's about film.
I don't know what you're
talking
about.
And we want to talk about film and the potential of film. And that all interests me too, but sometimes I worry that if we put that as the highest bar for what defines a great movie, we're leaving out a lot of stuff that is doing very different things really well, like I think Children of Heaven does.
I agree with you, and I think the counter to that would be a movie like The Bicycle Thief, which I think is just as simple and straightforward and I think is a masterpiece. And I don't think it's trying to do anything with the camera or visually in terms of its strategy that rivals A Moment of Innocence or Close Up. But something about The Bicycle Thief in terms of its grittiness, in terms of its realness, in contrast to the artificiality of this movie, that felt like this is a case where Children of Heaven really was just trying to sort of give me a nice, pleasing entertainment. And I don't think The Bicycle Thief is trying to do that, but manages to do that as well, maybe is the distinction I'm trying to make. But you're right. This is a case where we shouldn't be damning this film because it's straightforward. It was very pleasant to watch. I absolutely enjoyed it. I think many people listening would enjoy it as well. In fact, I would go so far as to say that only the most cynical, cold-hearted person could watch this film and not on just the basic story level, not appreciate what it's doing.
Yeah, I think it would be hard to hate on Children of Heaven, but I'm sure someone out there has.
Oh, I'm sure.
We'll find them.
Yeah, we'll get that email. We do want to know what you think of this film. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. I said maybe this was a good film to jump on board the marathon with, even though it's the third movie. We have three films left, and it's going to be a few weeks before we get to that fourth film. It's from Jafar Panahi, who had a great film out this year, This Is Not a Film. Speaking of other
well, how about that? It's about movie making.
Are about movie making. Hey, the Iranians do love their meta movies, but we'll get to The Mirror in a few weeks, and it's available via Netflix if you're a subscriber. So we'd love to get a few more people on board with this marathon.
If you think Julianne Moore is the first and last word in movie redheads, think again. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us. This house of our hands in our time, our blood. This something one day to fall down and cross in you. This house of your hands in your time.
Thank you time here on the show as we get to our very generous donors, everyone who has thrown a few bucks our way in support of Film Spotting. It's as always brought to you by Jeff Goldsmith and his great podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, which you can get in iTunes. And last week we mentioned his Chinatown episode from the Turner Classic Movies Festival. He had Robert Town talking with Robert Evans, of course, the screenwriter and the producer of that film. And he's following that up with another really good one, Robert Evans talking about Rosemary's Baby from the 2012 TCM Festival. I love Rosemary's Baby. And Robert Evans is always entertaining, as anyone who's seen the movie about his life can attest. So look for that. Just do a search in iTunes for The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith.
Also a reminder that Jeff's new digital magazine is out, Backstory. It's launched with issue number one. It's out and free for the iPad.
So there you go. If you are a lucky iPad owner, you can get Backstory now free. Just two quick notes before we get to our donors. We did mention, Josh, we've put it off for a couple weeks. Frankly, just forgot about it with so many things going on. Haven't really had a chance to catch our breath. But we did have a poster contest for the 400th episode of Film Spotting. Got 8 to 10 submissions. All pretty good. We'll post them at filmspotting.net, and we'll also announce the winner at filmspotting.net. You're going to get some swag. A Film Spotting t-shirt or two will be certainly part of that mix. And if you want to check that out, just go to filmspotting.net and look in the top stories. I also do want to mention, even though we reinforced it last week and you heard it from Matt and Allison as well, but if you're a fan of Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore's work on Film Spotting streaming video unit, and if you're not, you should be, go to iTunes and please do a search for SVU, do a search for Streaming Video Unit, and subscribe to their show in iTunes, because moving forward, we're not going to put that show in the main Film Spotting feed. So if you want to subscribe to it, you're going to get it from their own unique feed, which, as I said, you can get just by doing a search in iTunes.
And that's going to be weekly pretty soon, too.
And pretty
right?
soon, our plan is to make that a weekly show. We're
nice.
Very, very excited about that. Let's get to our donations, Josh, and let's start with a nice message here from Ursula, a new $5 a month donor.
When my friend Anand climbed up on stage for Massacre Theater at Film Spotting 400 last week,
Anand,
and totally outed me as the longtime listener who'd gotten him into Film Spotting, I knew I'd probably freeloaded long enough. I've listened for 2 years now, and Film Spotting has been an especially important companion since I took up running a year and a half ago and started training for half marathons. Hearing my name on the podcast last week was seriously thrilling, by the way. Anyway, yesterday was my birthday, and I decided my gift to myself would be another year of Film Spotting guilt-free at $5 a month. Anyway, nice Chicago and top five list connections to Film Spotting, and don't worry, you guys aren't nearly as snobby as Rob, Dick, and Barry.
We do appreciate that, Ursula. We appreciate your support. I'm very sorry that you had to get a present for yourself that was donating money to Film Spotting. I feel like we should do something for you more than just getting our show, but I don't know. Maybe we'll have another meetup at some point. We can at least buy you a drink for
your
birthday. Thank you, as always, to all of our great monthly donors, not only our $5 a month, but some $2 a month and $10 a month in the mix as well. A Silver Club donor, this would be Kim in Pflugerville, Texas, which is really fun to say. And other donors we want to thank this week, longtime supporter of the show, Keith in Ocean City, Maryland, and Jeff in San Jose, California, who threw out a little challenge for us that we're not going to digress and debate.
We're not?
Primarily because there's nothing to really debate here about this. He wants to know, what is the better Martin Scorsese film? Everybody says it's Raging Bull. He says it's clearly Taxi Driver.
It's Raging Bull.
It's definitely Raging Bull.
Okay, good.
I mean, I love Taxi Driver. Don't get me wrong. I do.
We're not going to digress, then.
No,
we
we're not going to digress. So, sorry, Jeff. It's as simple as that. We also got this one from Eleanor in Melbourne, Australia.
I just finished my design degree, and listening to your podcast helped me get through many long nights of doing work. You even inspired me to take a film screening class, where I got to see films such as Badlands, With Nail and I, Inland Empire, and Chungking Express, all films I'm not sure I would have even heard of if it weren't for your show.
Well, thank you so much, Eleanor. Certainly seeing some great films. Congratulations on finishing your degree. Leslie in West Sacramento, California.
I actually donated to you guys since I am now addicted to the podcast, so I need to pay the dealer.
I love that. I want to use that. I think that needs to be a new Film Spotting t-shirt. Pay the dealer.
I like it.
You're getting your fix every week of the cine crack, as they used to call it.
Pay up.
The dealer.
At last, I have some place to get recommendations and reviews of films that are actually based on the quality of the movies. I'm sick and tired of fanboy, fangirl reviews on places like Amazon and Netflix that provide really terrible assessments of the movies. Since when is the Twilight Saga a set of five-star films?
I think she's asking you that, actually, Josh. I mean, why did you give it five stars?
I have not even seen the last Twilight movie,
okay.
So don't try that.
Well, you just said the last Twilight movie. I still haven't seen any.
You haven't?
No.
Twilight Marathon.
Never gonna happen. This one coming in from David in Reykjavik, Iceland.
I just recently found your podcast and have listened to over 100 episodes in 14 days. I also want to thank you I also want to thank you for bringing my attention to movies I've never even heard of, such as The Apartment, which I just loved, and Glengarry Glen Ross, Cool Hand Luke, and much, much more. I'm donating some of my hard-earned cash, as you like to say so very often, but I will not see it as a donation, mainly because you have helped me come through 12 hours of night shifts so many times and made working so much more fun. Also want to give a shout-out to all the Icelandic listeners out there.
Go Iceland. Thank
yes.
you, David, very much for that. Two more here. Paul Breeny in Seattle.
I just watched Rian Johnson's Brick and heartily enjoyed it. I never even would have heard of it,
this
much less
theme.
Seen it.
There's a refrain.
I know,
this
I
week,
like
huh?
this. I never would have even heard of it, much less seen it, without Film Spotting. I've been listening for about a year now, and this is my first donation, though it won't be my last. I'm 22 and owe you guys and Maddie for broadening my film horizons considerably. Even when you're dead wrong.
Thanks for throwing that in.
Little
we go
there.
To this one, the last one from Mark Kearney. He's in Essex Junction, Vermont. He says, I expect more to come as soon as I feel guilty. Again, for so much great free film speak and entertainment. Thank you for the reliable information storehouse that is the internet. You are the number one film podcast and well-deserved. Where is your award?
Is there an award?
I think that's another t-shirt that's coming.
Where's our award?
7 years doing this. Where's our award?
Time for an award.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I was going to see about taking the GED. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm. High school to graduate.
Excuse me, I never got my diploma. I feel bad, you know, that... I think you were right about that. I think you were right.
You should do it. You should do it, Roller Girl, because you know what? If you wanted to, you could do anything.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. It's time for the Film Spotting Top 5 this week, Screen Redheads. And we were inspired to do this by the new Pixar film Brave, which we discussed earlier in the show. A good inspiration because that character, Princess Merida, very much reflected in that wild mane of hair, that scarlet red hair that she has. And you just heard a scene from Julianne Moore and the Paul Thomas Anderson movie Boogie Nights. As we threw this topic out on Twitter and Facebook, a lot of people wrote back with, well, just pick your five favorite Julianne Moore performances.
Yep.
And you could almost do that. But Josh, we, of course, had to make it a little bit more complicated than that.
We had higher standards.
Yeah.
Our ideal was that the red hair had thematic resonance or somehow directly reflected the character.
Mm-hmm.
So we really wanted to be more than just an actor or actress who had red hair. Failing that, I kind of thought of it as maybe, you know, best performances given by redheads. But the more I looked at it, I didn't need to do that.
No.
Because I did find, I think, we'll see, maybe you'll challenge me on some of them, but I think I did find where it was also a thematic element.
That was definitely the ideal I was after as well. And I was very clear about trying to make a list that wasn't the best performances by an actor or actress with red hair. I think that's completely different. That's where you can start factoring in Julianne Moore. You could make the entire top five just Katharine Hepburn roles,
mm-hmm.
for that matter, if you were just picking the best performances by redheads. But one Julianne Moore performance that really could have worked is the one we just heard from Boogie Nights.
Yep.
Amber Waves, that character very much reflected there in her name. I also think she's a very interesting, very memorable screen character. So I don't know so much that the red hair factors in beyond her name, but she's one I definitely did consider for this list. And it's actually funny because on my way over here, I happen to be listening to the latest WTF episode, the podcast with Marc Maron, where he was talking to Jack White, of course, formerly of the White Stripes. And it just so happened that as I was driving here, I hit a point in the show where he started talking about the use of the color red and how he picked that color, the red and white dichotomy there, for the White Stripes as their theme, because he's always been fascinated by the color red and the power of it and the danger of the color red. And he referenced, for example, Nazi iconography uses the color red, but then you've just got major brands like Coke,
mm-hmm.
and the Red Cross, and he mentioned fire trucks, of course, and his phrase was something like, there's a lot of inspiration and anger that comes from the color red. And I think he's right. So as I was thinking of my candidates for this list, I was trying to think about what the color red signified in terms of movies. So with that, what's your number five screen redhead?
Well, the idea of power does come into play on my list.
Good.
A little later on. Number five, Franka Potenta in Run, Lola, Run. Tom Tykwer's 1998 crime thriller, which is about a woman who has 20 minutes to recover a huge amount of money that her low-level criminal of a boyfriend has lost. I may be cheating a bit here, as Potenta isn't a natural redhead, but I think her bright red, it's almost a primary red dye job, does play a crucial part in the film. Tykwer sends Lola on three different runs in the movie, each of which has slight variations that result in long-term implications. It's sort of a butterfly effect that he has going on here. And Lola's constantly racing across the screen. She's bumping into people. She's weaving through crowds. So the red hair serves as a marker.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tag. We almost need it to keep up with her in this movie. And I thought about it when this has happened before. And as the camera kind of naturally finds her and gravitates toward her in each scene, it reminded me a little bit of the little girl in the red coat in Spielberg's Schindler's List. Obviously, completely different reasons for using it, but it's the same effect where that color is such an attraction to the eye that you lock in on it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we need to lock in on Lola as she's continually running in the film.
Run, Lola, Run, and that character is a fantastic choice. This list for me, I'm calling it the They're All Going to Laugh at You Carrie Memorial List, with a nod to our friend Scott Tobias, who we saw earlier in the
night. That was his suggestion.
It was his suggestion, and I really wrestled with how to fit Carrie on my list, because right away you think about Sissy Spacek, and you think about the color red of her hair, the way it comes back into play in terms of blood at the end of that film, and the blood early in the film, one of the inciting incidents with her character where we get to see how much of an outcast she is. Red plays a major role there. And I actually think Piper Laurie, if I'm remembering the film right, her mom, Margaret White, is also a redhead.
I think so, yeah.
So Carrie had to be represented here somehow. But for my number five, I'm going with Cynthia. That's the character from Dazed and Confused, with the curly red hair, played by the actress Marissa Ribisi. she hangs out with the geeks in that movie. And she just was, for me, one of the first redheads I thought of when we came up with this topic. Probably not only because of the red color, but just a very memorable hairstyle, that big curly style. And she's always picking at it. She has a very small role in the film, but she seems so cool. You wish you could spend more time with her. And without her, and without her hair, Josh, we might not have ever gotten this.
All right.
Oh, Christ.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Cool. You heard about the party being busted, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Not to worry. There's a new fiesta in the making as we speak. It's out at the Moon Tower. Full kegs. Everybody's gonna be there. You ought to go.
Okay.
Okay, we'll be there.
Okay.
Say you need a ride?
No, I got my own car. Thanks.
Yeah, well, listen, you ought to ditch the geeks in the car with now and get in with us, but that's all right. We'll worry about that later. I will see you there, all right?
Bye.
I love those redheads, man.
I know you.
I mean, talk about dialogue that changed the course of cinema history.
Yes,
all right. Love those redheads from Matthew McConaughey there in Dazed and Confused. Had to be represented on my list. And yes, I learned a lot of interesting little tidbits of trivia as I scoured the internets today to find redheads that were really memorable in movies. And it turns out, not surprisingly, Marissa Ribisi is in fact Giovanni Ribisi's sister, his twin sister.
Really?
Yeah.
Very interesting. How about that?
But Cynthia from Dazed and Confused is my number five.
I like that one. I didn't think of that, but it makes a lot of sense. My number four might be a cheat. We'll see what you say. We'll see what listeners say.
Okay.
But I went with Rita Hayworth and Gilda.
No, not a cheat at all.
Okay, good.
I'm so glad she was represented on this list.
It's, you know, black and white film, so I didn't know. But here was my out with that, is if you look for poster images from the era, and this was a sleazy 1946 noir, all the posters really emphasized Hayworth's red mane. It was like what they played up about the movie. Hayworth plays the wife of a Buenos Aires casino owner in Gilda. The owner has just hired a gambler to work for him, played by Glenn Ford. And we learn that Hayworth's character and the gambler have a complicated past. It's not just that she has the red hair here, but it's how she uses it. Hayworth tosses her hair so much in this film, it's almost like a supporting character.
Right.
It's really outrageous when you watch the whole thing. Now, Gilda also features Hayworth's rendition of Put the Blame on Mame, which is essentially a striptease, even though she's clothed during the whole thing. For these and other reasons, Hayworth is all anyone thinks about when Gilda is mentioned, even though she's actually not on the screen that much in the film itself.
I'm so glad you picked Gilda and Rita Hayworth, because I knew that if she wasn't represented somehow on either of our lists, we were going to hear about it. We were going to get a lot of foreshadowing.
Yeah, I had to have her on here.
Well, well done, Josh, with that. My number four, let's see if you can get it here. I'm going to challenge you a little bit. The character's name, I want you to tell me the nickname that matters and the name of the movie. The character is Sherry Valance.
No.
Not ringing a bell.
It's not.
That would be Cherry Valance from the Francis Ford Coppola movie, The Outsiders.
Ah.
Diane Lane in her breakout screen role. She, of course, had another memorable turn in Rumblefish, Francis Ford Coppola doing another S.E. Hinton novel. But she's the soch with a conscience. She is the preppy girl, the beautiful preppy girl who doesn't treat the greasers, C. Thomas Howell and Ralph Macchio, like they're scum. And, of course, Cherry Valance, that memorable red hair reflected in her name, Cherry. And she does give you, I think, the best line ever in movies, exemplifying the constant need for the good girl to be attracted to the bad boy. This is after she meets Matt Dillon in the film playing Dallas Winston. She says, "I hope I never see Dallas Winston again. If I do, I'd probably fall in love with him." And that really does, I think, sum it up. And, of course, how could you not fall in love with Matt Dillon in that role? So Cherry Valance, another one that immediately came to mind for me. Interesting little trivia associated with this film, Josh, according to Wikipedia. The Outsiders, and your wife is a librarian, so maybe she can comment on this. It's apparently a fairly controversial book. It was ranked number 38 on the American Library Association's top 100 most frequently challenged books of 1990 to 1999.
Oh,
so
yeah.
School boards come together and they say, it's not just in movies like Field of Dreams. They actually come together in real life and say, these books are ruining our children. They shouldn't be reading these books. Huck Finn probably,
I'm sure,
comes up. It's a sad
truth. This happens.
And apparently The Outsiders, because of gang violence, underage smoking and drinking, and the strong language, and the fact that it's all about a dysfunctional family with no parents, apparently that makes it
the horror
not suitable for teen kids. Give me a break. I read The Outsiders as a teen.
And look what happened to you.
You're
a delinquent.
I'm a delinquent. You're right. That's not really going to help our cause, but I love The Outsiders. Cherry Valance is my number four.
Very nice. Number three, the representative man on my list, Denzel Washington and Malcolm X.
Wow, they even called him Red.
They did.
Yeah.
It's one of the historical details that Spike Lee hews to for his biopic. It's the red tinge that Malcolm X had to his hair. And yeah, when we see him in his youth, and that's when he was known as Detroit Red. Now, hairstyle is kind of a minor theme throughout the movie as it relates to Malcolm's sense of identity. Early on, when he is Detroit Red, we see him getting his hair straightened with a burning chemical relaxer, if you remember this scene. Lee's actually the one giving the treatment. And it's worth noting that it's played for laughs a little bit when it's burning and burning. They go to wash it off. There's no water in the apartment, and he's running all over. And finally, he dunks his head in the toilet to seek relief. But it's also really important because that's an act of humiliation. So it's echoing this theme of trying to look white or be white instead of being true to your identity. You're being false to your heritage by going after this style. So I just thought that that was a nice touch in how many levels that scene worked on for someone who, you know, redheads, you don't think of Malcolm X, but yeah.
Take your head out of this ball. That's it. Get up slowly. Hey, watch. No funny business now.
Red. Jig is up.
Inspired pick, Josh. I think that's a great one. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five screen redheads. And my number three, already mentioned by you, I think probably the only overlap we're going to get on our list, but I also had to have Lola Franca Potenta from Run Lola Run, the Tom Tykwer movie. Very much a sense. I'm going to echo a lot of the things, repeat probably a lot of what you said, but dyed red hair, clearly not real, not genuine, but that matches the heightened style of the film. And it almost turns her into a superhero type character or a video game type character, someone outside the norms of reality. She has special powers and she's been imbued with some kind of ability, and the hair, I think, really does reflect that. It shows her independence, that she's going to be someone who is going to go after whatever it is she wants doggedly and is not going to be deterred along the way. And the color red really does come up throughout the film quite a bit, but I think it just is one of those things, as we're going to see as we go through this list and with redheads in general on screen, I think, is that there is that sense of fierce independence, of danger, of charisma, of power that really comes through by having her with that unmistakable bright red hair. So Lola from Run Lola Run is my number three. That brings us to our number two.
Number two, going back to what you said at the beginning about red reflecting power, Cate Blanchett and Elizabeth. It's a historical drama, but as it's staged by director Shekhar Kapoor, it's also a one-woman fashion show. It's about Elizabeth's rise to power, and her look is part of that transformation. Early on, the red hair is part of kind of her free-spirited attitude. It sets her apart in a good-natured way. But then as she gets a firmer grasp on power, she begins shutting herself off from all emotion. Then it becomes a defense mechanism, sort of like the elaborate costumes. The increasingly elaborate costumes become defense mechanisms. And I was thinking about how it's used in the film and looking back at some of the images again. And her hair kind of, the red hair bursts out of those frocks. And it's almost like the bright colors of a frilled lizard that flashes its tinted skin, you know, to scare predators away, if you've seen that image.
Right.
That's kind of what it brought to mind. So it's that red is like danger and power is how she uses it.
I definitely did consider that performance because I considered Cate Blanchett and how great she is in so many films. At the same time, I think that's a performance I appreciate so much more than the movie, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So maybe kind of pushed it down my list a little bit, but absolutely a good pick and certainly more highbrow than my number two choice. I'm going back to high school for my top five. I've had Cherry Valance from Outsiders. I've had Cynthia from Dazed and Confused. And we get to my one guy on the list. It's actually Keith Nelson, Eric Stoltz from Some Kind of Wonderful, an 80s movie I really do like. And speaking of going back to high school, I found on Popwatch over at entertainmentweekly.com today, there was an article that basically says, you know, according to Science Magazine, only 2% of humanity has naturally red hair, but approximately 100% of high school comedies feature redheaded leads. Obviously an exaggeration, but the writer was referencing Molly Ringwald and all the John Hughes movies, Lindsay Lohan and Mean Girls, Emma Stone, in Easy A. You can throw in Angela Chase from My So-Called Life. And as the writer says, you've got nearly 25 years of redhead domination in high school. They even come up with a name for it, the red-haired high school outcast goddess.
Nice.
So the red hair does reflect that kind of Carrie outcast nature, something different, something that stands out about this character. And that comes through with Keith, played by Eric Stoltz, in Some Kind of Wonderful. He is not necessarily a rebel, but someone who's just a little bit different. The hair, actually, I was thinking about this today. If you look at pictures from that movie of Eric Stoltz, his hair, kind of like Lola in Run, Lola, Run, seems a little bit fake. It seems as if they were trying to make him stand out from everyone else a little bit by having this really striking red hair. And it turns out, I found a Q&A with Martha Coolidge, who is the director of Dana Stevens' beloved film Valley Girl, my beloved film from the 80s, Real Genius. And she was originally supposed to direct Some Kind of Wonderful. She cast Eric Stoltz, and she actually had them make his hair darker red, dye it a little darker shade of red so it would be more striking. And as I reflect on that movie, I want to say Amanda Jones, the love interest in that movie, Leah Thompson, another character who stands out from her world, the same way Keith is a guy who kind of goes between two different worlds, but stands out as his own unique person. Amanda Jones, similarly, has more depth than we give her credit for in the circle she runs with, and she has red hair. My trivia associated with this movie, Josh, is that Leah Thompson went on to marry the person who actually did direct Some Kind of Wonderful, Howard Deutsch.
How about that? I'm loving this trivia. This is just so informative.
The internet is an amazing, amazing thing. But
you wasted a lot of time on this, didn't you?
I did indeed. But Keith Jones, come on. Great character. That movie never ceases to make me laugh whenever it comes on. I love Elias Koteas, who plays kind of his biker, outcast, rebel friend in that movie. They become friends through detention, but I'm a big fan of Some Kind of Wonderful.
This is not true. It can't be. This has got to be, like, the most hilarious rumor ever floated, right?
What are you talking about?
Okay, I'm in town last night. I hear everybody talking about how Keith has asked this girl out.
No way.
Check it out. This girl is popular. She's beautiful and obviously in the middle of some emotional shootout to consent to date the human tater tot. What did you do to her, Keith? Threaten her life?
I just asked her out.
I did want to find a way to get Eric Stoltz on the list, so I'm glad you put him on yours. My number one, though, is Moira Shearer as Vicki Page in The Red Shoes. This is perhaps the definitive Technicolor film. It's Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's production from 1948. It could have worked without Technicolor, but watching the movie, you almost get the feeling that Technicolor was invented for it.
Yeah.
And what this means for star Moira Shearer, who made her debut here, actually, is that her red hair is of a thematic piece with a film that's all about full-blooded artistic passion. Shearer plays a new dancer at a world-famous ballet company who gets caught between a romance with the company's young composer and the artistic demands of its director. How intense are these people? When the director, who's played by Anton Walbrook, asks Shearer's Vicki Page, "Why do you want to dance?" she wins a spot by answering, "Why do you want to live?"
Uh-huh.
The entire film is filled with rich, saturated hues, never more so than the Ballet of the Red Shoes sequence, which is kind of its centerpiece. It begins on this traditional stage with Vicki Page dancing in front of a mirror, and eventually it ends up as a full-out fantasy, and Vicki is soaring through this multicolored sky, and her hair is one of those crucial colors.
Well, apparently we should have called this the Vicki Page Red Shoes Memorial.
Oh, you're kidding.
Because, alas, we do have some more overlap. Moira Shearer, Vicki Page is my number one as well from the great Powell Pressburger film, The Red Shoes. And I think it's only fitting. Nice bookend here. We started the show talking about Brave, inspired our top five, a movie about a Scottish princess with red hair. And we end with someone the New York Times referred to in her obituary as a Scottish beauty with flaming red hair.
Hmm.
And she was a classically trained ballet dancer. She is, of course, the star not only of The Red Shoes, but of a 1955 British film called The Man Who Loved Redheads. So seems like Moira Shearer needs to be somewhere on this list. I think you articulated why the red in her hair really makes it perfect for this film and some of the thematic resonance, but it also does just make her stand out the way it does with all the characters in our list. There is a vitality to her, a certain life to her that comes through because of that red hair. And as you see her character become more and more bewitched by those red shoes, there's this spirit almost that overtakes her when she wears them. It matches her hair. It almost suggests to you that she was born to wear these red shoes. Just look at her hair that matches those shoes so well. And you're right, the 17-minute dance sequence, I said it when we discussed the film as part of our Archer's marathon on this show. If the ballet was actually as exciting as Powell and Pressburger and the cinematographer Jack Cardiff make it, I'd be at the ballet every week.
It'd be a season.
Because
subscriber, huh?
It's that dynamic,
yeah.
And that pleasing to watch. And yeah, the Red Shoes and Vicky Page had to be represented here. So there you go. Some double love from Film Spotting, essentially our joint number one pick, the Red Shoes. Any honorable mentions, Josh, for you?
Yeah, I want to give some credit to some Film Spotting Advisory Board members who gave some good suggestions I would have liked to include. Greg mentioned Anthony Michael Hall as Rusty Griswold from National Lampoon's Vacation. That would have been great. And here's an inspired one that I didn't even think of, but would fit. Mufasa. Kamaria suggested Mufasa from The Lion King. Yeah.
Well, I'll stick with Disney. I don't know how you can have this list and not mention Ariel from The Little Mermaid.
Yeah, I thought about
that. Go to my childhood as well. Little Orphan Annie, a strong competitor for this list. John Huston directed that film, Albert Finney is Daddy Warbucks. Killing me.
Annie is kind of annoying.
Oh, I love that movie. I loved that movie when I was a kid. Watched it over and over again. Mentioned Amber Waves from Boogie Nights and Carrie from Carrie. This was hard because sometimes it really is difficult to tell, and you can't really get a clear ruling somewhere on the internet always whether or not someone really has red hair or it's just sort of a strawberry blonde or a brunette. But I think of Angie Dickinson as Feathers in Rio Bravo.
Yeah, I thought about Angie Dickinson.
I think
Dickinson,
of her as having red hair. Molly Ringwald from the John Hughes movies. Deborah Carr, another Powell Pressburger film, Black Narcissus. Tilda Swinton from Orlando. I do love Emma Stone from Easy A. And you have to throw in Spencer Tracy was a redhead, so
yep.
Another person along with Katharine Hepburn, appropriately, that you'd have to think of as giving some great performances by redheads. I don't know how much his hair ever mattered in those roles, but then again, there are a lot of Spencer Tracy movies I need to see. So this ended up being a pretty fun list. I thought it was pretty trivial when you first suggested it, but then a lot of Film Spotting listeners.
Twist your arm a little bit.
We got some other people on Facebook who thought it would be a good idea. We went with it. I had fun with it, Josh.
Good.
So those are our top five screen redheads. Send us your picks or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting or at facebook.com/filmspotting.
How do we summarize this week's show? A lot of color red. Obviously, I would say if you haven't seen The Red Shoes, if you haven't seen Run Lola Run,
yeah,
those would be good films
definitely.
To start with.
Probably The Red Shoes for sure, because
yeah.
I'm thinking maybe people haven't, and that one is one of the greats for musicals.
Yeah, Brave, the latest Pixar film, their 13th film, the first one to feature a female protagonist. It did work very nicely for both of us. And Children of Heaven, another film like Brave from our Iranian cinema marathon, centered on two children, very much a film that I think parents could watch with their kids,
yeah.
Even if the thought of watching an Iranian film, a foreign language film, maybe seems a little bit odd to you, it really would be a good choice.
Just be prepared if they can't read, you're going to have your throat ready for reading those subtitles.
Out wide this weekend, the new Pixar film Brave, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and the new Steve Carell film, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, Keira Knightley in that movie as well, as I recall. In limited release, the new Todd Solondz film, Dark Horse, one that has been getting some pretty interesting reviews so far, and I really am excited to see it. Natural Selection, this is a film starring Rachel Harris, the comedian, used to be on The Daily Show, and I don't know much about this movie, but I've heard her talk about it, and I know it's gotten some decent buzz at festivals. Payback is out as well, a movie, Josh, until I was preparing these notes, I had never heard of, but it's a documentary. It's opening here in Chicago this weekend. It's an adaptation of Margaret Atwood's book, Examining the Metaphor of Indebtedness, and it's got some really interesting people in it, real people, obviously. Eric Schlosser, the person who wrote Fast Food Nation, is one of the featured participants in it. Something about that just sounds really fascinating to me, and I'm curious to see it. Also out, The Woman in the Fifth. This is a new thriller starring Ethan Hawke and Kristen Scott Thomas. Next week on the show, Michael Phillips will be here. We call him Magic Michael Phillips.
Oh, do we?
Yeah,
okay.
Why not?
I'll have to use that.
We'll talk about Magic Mike, the new Steven Soderbergh film, and reveal our top five films of 2012 so far.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Manchester Orchestra. Learn more at themanchesterorchestra.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Mike, Check, 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 mic, check, check, check.
Out of the ash I rise with my red hair and eat men like air. Did you know that offhand or did
no.
you?
Quotes about redheads.
That's
what I Googled.
Okay.
You should watch what you do when you.
I believe
when
it.
When you Google various things that involve the word redheads.
Yeah. I can imagine. Although you realize I have the harder part trying to keep the straight face.
I know. Well, yeah, but I'm not as good as you, Josh.
Giuseppe Petri.
Jeez, I knew it. That's all you need, one thieving wop on the team.
What's that you said?
I said that you're a lion member of a no good race.
That's much
Raish.
Better than that's much better than you, you stinking Irish pig.
Let's go back.
You should keep it that way.
I know. No good race. I'm going to say that again.
I thought it was
okay,
good.
I should have kept it.